Yes, I'm really glad we got to hear her first. Makes me feel very good. Thank you, Patrice. Very kind. Let's see. Okay, I'll be speaking this morning on women's wealth and patrimonial violence, highlighting some of those themes that Dr. Franco just brought to the fore in terms of women's property rights and the accumulation of assets or wealth. Now, some of you might be wondering, what is patrimonial violence? You know, it isn't a very common term, and it is a direct translation from the Spanish, because we really don't have sort of an equivalent concept. Generally, when we think about forms of violence against women, you know, we think of physical violence, sexual violence, verbal and or psychological violence. But much less attention has been given to the different forms of economic violence, and particularly patrimonial violence. Now, we can think of patrimonial violence as a subset of economic violence, but there's a couple reasons it's useful to separate. Economic violence tends to be used to refer to women's ability to generate an income, or control income. Whereas when we're focusing on patrimonial violence, we're focusing on women's property rights or the kinds of constraints that they might face in accumulating property or assets, broadly defined. In Latin America, we see that a number of countries have taken the lead in actually now including patrimonial violence within their domestic violence laws. This is really the second generation of domestic violence laws. You know, the initial ones were passed in the 80s. We've had a new round over the last decade. And as you can see on the slide, Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, Costa Rica, Honduras, Mexico, and Venezuela have now included patrimonial violence, defined as the denial of women's property rights or the right to individual and community property. And I'll be distinguishing between these two in a second. For example, what is sanctioned? These four clauses come from the Costa Rica law. If the husband steals, damages, or destroys his wife's property, when he prohibits her from using, managing, or disposing of her own property, if he commits any kind of fraud regarding the couple's community property, and if he appropriates for himself the profits from a family business. So these are some of the kinds of patrimonial violence that are now sanctioned by law. And the reason this is so important is that in the Hispanic legal tradition, spouses couldn't bring suits against each other. And this is still one of the defining characteristics of the civil code or codified tradition in Latin America. So it's really quite a breakthrough saying, okay, there's lots of situations in which husbands, but also wives, most of these laws, I should say, are gender neutral. They can apply to either men or women. When they abuse their rights and responsibilities within marriage or consensual unions. Okay, today I'm going to be addressing three main questions. First, whether women are aware of their property rights and if these are honored in practice. Two, in what kinds of situations is patrimonial violence most likely to occur? And are women's property rights sufficiently strong so that they are able to accumulate assets or wealth on par with men? These questions are derived directly from feminist theory, feminist economics specifically, in terms of some of the major concerns in our field. And there are further development of three propositions. At first, that women's well-being and that of her family is directly related to her ownership of property or assets. Second, that the ownership of assets is an important determinant of women's fallback position should the household dissolve. The fallback position is what you would be left with if the marriage or consensual union breaks up. You know, basically, whether you would have enough property to be able to survive, or more broadly, you know, also the human capital for any other income-generating activities. Perhaps the most interesting, and where I've been going with my research, is in terms of the third question, is the relationship between women's fallback position, if she can actually leave the marriage, or if she considers she has the option to do so, and how that's related to her bargaining power within the household. And this key proposition here is that the more secure women feel about their property rights, the more secure they feel that they've got an option outside marriage, the more likely they are to voice their opinion within the marriage, right? Because their threat point, as economists would call it, is much stronger. You know, if things really don't go well, or if they're in an abusive relationship, you know, the option of leaving is so much stronger. A related proposition is that women's ownership of assets or property, their stronger fallback position, is also inversely related to domestic violence. And we have now some the beginning of an empirical basis for that proposition. A study in India found that women that owned their own home or that owned land were much likely to suffer domestic violence. So property in some ways acts as a deterrent to physical and sexual violence in particular. And another aspect of this is that the stronger the woman's fallback position, the more likely that the children are going to treat their mother well in their senior years. In other words, the greater the possibility of inheritance, you know, the more likely you are to help out your aging parents, which is something we can all relate to. Okay, the empirical work I'm presenting today is from Ecuador, where I had the privilege of spending a sabbatical in 2009-2010. The study I carried out in Ecuador was part of a comparative study funded by the Dutch government that also included Ghana and the state of Karnataka in India. So we had really a wonderful opportunity to carry out the study with similar methodology in three regions of the world in very different contexts. And in my conclusion, I'll be referring to some of those comparative aspects. The field work that we carried out, we spent 6 months doing field work in three provinces of Ecuador. The main method were focus groups. We organized these primarily with popular sector women, both urban and rural, but also with, we had some mixed groups, and we interviewed, or had at least one focus group with rural men in each one of these provinces. And in order to get a better sense of social norms, we also did focus groups with professional women in each one of the, or middle class women in each one of these provinces. We also did, as you can see, a whole slew of interviews with key informants. You know, we were particularly interested in getting the opinions of folks in the legal profession. But we were also studying the markets for assets. You know, so we interviewed real estate agents. And that's not a very common practice, you know, to get an idea, you know, of how transactions over land and houses are actually carried out. We also studied animal markets and, of course, the whole microfinance sector. So all of this was, well, we were interested in the qualitative aspects on their own, but this is what really helped us to prepare a household survey that would be context specific. We had started out actually a number of years before, three of the five co-principal investigators on the project, where we had had the opportunity to review all of the household living standards surveys that the World Bank had sponsored around the world. And after that review and seeing how inadequate these major surveys are, we were given the opportunity to design our own questionnaire or research instrument. So this is what we had started out with, and the idea of the field work was that it would help us make it context specific, while still working within a generally comparative context. We needed to have the same outcome, which was to be able to measure household wealth and individual wealth, that is, men's and women's wealth within households. And what was innovative about our survey was just that. The World Bank, LSMS surveys, always focused on the household and rarely asked our key question, to whom does the house belong? Or who are the owners, of the land parcel? So it's just putting something in the plural and adding one more column to those surveys that opens up a whole world for gender analysis. We, of course, went much further in designing the questionnaire that we actually carried out, as you'll see by the kinds of questions. So our survey was carried out in 2010 and ended up with almost 3,000 households and is nationally representative, rural and urban, highland, and coastal regions in Ecuador. One other word on methodology. Part of what I'd like to demonstrate in this presentation today is the mix of qualitative and quantitative methods and why both are really necessary. Not the great problem, but one of the deficiencies of economic analysis is often that it's not based on field work, on the ground, particularly within development economics. It's informed by theory, but doesn't really reflect very well the behavior of individuals and the households to which they belong. And part of what I'm going to illustrate is that it's not always easy to reconcile quantitative information and qualitative information. So you're going to see a number of contradictions where what we had thought was going to be the main quantitative result was quite different than our expectations. And you'll also see my struggle to try to interpret why that's the case. And of course, welcome your answers and the ones that I try to ignore because we still haven't puzzled them out. Okay, our field work, where we did the qualitative work, was in two regions of the highlands, that's the central part of Ecuador, and then on the coast, that's culturally quite different in Ecuador. The highlands are the indigenous mestizo, the coast is white mestizo and Afro-Ecuadorian as you go towards the north. Okay, what are women's property rights in Ecuador? Okay, the main two things that one is concerned with when considering property rights in terms of the family is the marital regime and the inheritance regime. So what the marital regime is about is to whom does property belong that you've acquired before marriage and that you acquire during the marriage. Now, the Hispanic tradition is that partial community property is the norm. And the rules for partial community property is that any assets acquired prior to marriage belong to you alone. Okay, so what you've earned as single always remains yours throughout the marriage, and if the marriage breaks up, you get to claim them and take them with you. However, what makes it community property is the second block here, that any assets acquired during the marriage belong to the couple, irrespective of whose income is used to purchase them. Okay. If the couple breaks up, well, it's these community assets that are then split in equal shares. Okay. The other individual property are inheritances. Those are always individual property, you know, made by parents, you know, to their child in the child's name. You know, unless in a will they write out the couple, but it's assumed that these are individual level. So the reason that we call this regime partial community property is that everything that's acquired during marriages except inheritance is community property. But you do have these two forms of individual property. Under full community property, everything, each one of these columns, would be part of the community property, and that would be divided in half. And in Latin America, it was Brazil. Actually, the Luso, or the Portuguese tradition, that was based on full community property, but they switched in the 1980s. The third regime that we find now in some of the Central American countries, Nicaragua, Honduras, and Costa Rica, is separation of property. And there, everything you acquire before marriage remains yours. Everything you purchase during marriage is only yours. Inheritances are only yours. And when you divorce, there's nothing to split up, you know, unless you explicitly declare it to be the case. And the marital regimes in every country are flexible enough that anyone can go to a public notary and do what's called a capitulación, which is a legal arrangement saying, rather than the default, you know, what governs if nothing else is declared, I'm going to declare that, you know, this particular house is going, that I inherited, is going to belong to the two of us. You know, or this property that I got before marriage is going to belong to the two of us, or that what I'm going to earn or purchase with my earnings is going to be mine alone and not my husband's because he's independently wealthy and he da-da-da-da. You know, so whatever you want to do, you can basically do it. But I'll always be referring to the default marital regime, you know, what happens unless you declare otherwise. Okay, another important aspect of marital regimes is the situation of consensual unions, or what we call in the U.S. tradition, common law marriages. In the case of Ecuador, and it's generally the case in Latin America, that during the 1980s, most countries recognized consensual unions and gave them the same marital property rights as formal marriages, but you have to meet certain conditions. They've got to be monogamous, they have to be stable, of at least 2 years duration, and you can't be married to someone else. So it doesn't apply to the casa chica, you know, in that casa grande, casa chica tradition. With respect to the inheritance regime, in all Latin American countries, drawing on the Luso Hispanic tradition, all children, irrespective of sex, inherit equally from their parents. So this is the key law of succession. Okay, let's turn then to what actually happens, or what we found on the ground. And this part of the presentation is organized according to marital status. Yeah, so we'll first look at marital and consensual unions, then what happens during divorce, separation, and widowhood. And FG stands for the focus groups. Okay, in the focus groups, you know, we found that you know, women were quite aware of the partial community property. In Ecuador, it's called the Sociedad Conjugal. In other South American countries, it's called gananciales. That term might be familiar to some of them. But you know, they knew that marriage gave you property rights, and that, you know, the essence of marriage was really sharing, you know, all of your income and what you purchase. But people were a little bit less certain about consensual unions. And we found, particularly among the popular sectors, that there was this tendency to identify the owner of an asset with the person whose income was used to purchase it. So an example of patrimonial violence is the following quote from one of our participants. Everything is in his name because he's the one that works, right? You know, even though we're married or even though we're in a consensual union. So there is a still strong identification with income generation and the ability to purchase assets as being your own. Nonetheless, in our survey, when we asked this question, you know, if you're married or in a consensual union, to whom does the property that you purchase with your own income belong? You'll see that the great majority of our respondents, you know, answered that it belongs to the couple, you know, that this is joint community property. So this really confirmed what we felt in the focus groups, you know, that most people understood that that marriage, you know, and consensual unions inferred joint property. Nonetheless, if you look down at the left, you'll see, you know, a relatively small percentage. You know, of women in particular that answered that, no, you know, the assets belong to the person who purchased it with their own income. You know, probably reflecting the confusion that had surfaced in the focus groups. So this response is pretty much consistent with what we had expected and would support the proposition that women are generally aware about the benefits that come with marriage in particular. Okay, there's also other forms of legal protection for married women regarding joint assets in marriage. And not all of Latin America, or not all countries have this. They have what's called la doble firma, the double signature, which is that to sell an asset, and if you're married, both husband and wife must sign. And the same thing applies in terms of taking out formal credit of any sort. This is real important because if a husband wants to sell, you know, the house or a car, etc., he really needs, you know, her consent. However, we found in the focus groups a number of different ways that that men get around this when they want to. One is pure falsification, right? You know, who can stop you from signing from your spouse if there isn't really all the mechanisms of follow-up? Also, we found in a number of focus groups, you know, women would report how, well, you know, the wife doesn't really care about all that paperwork and all those material things. You know, if the husband brings something and she just signs away, you know, and just doesn't really pay any attention. You know, and then we've got other forms of deception, such as a husband that's already thinking in terms of separation or divorce, starting to put assets in the name of his mother, you know, or some other family member, so that at the moment of, let's say, divorce, it doesn't appear as part of that joint property that's to be divided. We also found in the focus groups a certain degree of confusion over individual property. Or women were clear, you know, about community property and how that was formed in marriage, but not all of them were sure about what they had brought to marriage. And we noted in overall the groups this tendency among the popular sector women, again, for them to consider anything they might have brought to marriage as belonging to the family, but yet to consider things that the husband had brought, you know, such as his own bicycle, or in another middle class, his own car, as his asset, right? So it was a very gender differentiated view of assets. So that's part of what we could have seen in that first slide on the survey results. Okay, these next two slides refer to individual property. And it's the, this first one, once you marry, to whom does the property you acquired while single belong? And much to our surprise, you can see that the overwhelming number of respondents said that that property you acquired while single belongs to the couple and not the individuals. And only the group on the left corner were those that answered correctly, following the civil code, that that property belongs to individuals. It's also curious, and I'll be going into this in more detail, that more men, or more women than men, answered correctly that the property acquired before marriage belonged to you individually. We can see the same tendency in terms of inherited property. The correct answer would be that, oh yeah, inherited property belongs to me individually. But again, you can see that the majority of people said, no, it belongs to the couple. And a slightly higher share did report correctly that it belonged to you individually. So we were pretty surprised by these results. We saw the confusion in the focus groups, but the survey data says people are really confused. And so first you go, did we ask the question wrong? But we only asked it 600 times before we finally did the survey. We should have gotten it right in all the different field tests. So we think there's various things going on to these legal literacy questions, and that might explain why we're getting the same result. Majority of people saying it belongs to the couple, belongs to the couple, belongs to the couple, when it's clearly differentiated. One is that people could perhaps not really understand the question, no matter how much we field tested it. And so they're giving you what they think you want to hear. And they think that, hey, the couple is the socially appropriate answer. So they might not be sure, they might not have understood the question, but they'll give you the answer. And we know that's the problem always of surveys. A related interpretation is that this notion of community property could be really well entrenched, even though it disregards your rights over individual property. That people really feel that in marriage, the phrase in Spanish, la pareja tiene que estar unida. We heard that over and over. The couple has to be act as a unit, to be unified. However, when we started investigating some of the, both econometrically and in our descriptive statistics, what was going on, what we found were important differences in the respondents according to marital status. So this is the response on the group that answered correctly, right? So who were the ones that got it right? Let's say, that knew their property rights. Don't know if any of this brings surprise to any of you. Okay, it was primarily divorced women, separated women, and single women, right? And in fact, they were much clearer about their property rights than men in those same categories. So what this reflects for us, or suggests, is that people generally don't pay that much attention to property rights, right? You marry for love, right? You don't marry to secure patrimony. Although, that could be a motivation. I mean, there is that security in there. When you really think about it, is during separation and divorce, and widowhood. Because all of a sudden, that's really the most important issue besides custody of the kids, right? That's the first thing you're concerned with. And then the second is, hey, what happens to the house? What happens to all of our consumer durables and the car and this and that and the other? So What we suggest, again, based on the qualitative research to try to explain these apparent contradictions, is that it's the actual experience of divorce and separation that makes people aware of their property rights. So let's turn to divorce and where we see patrimonial violence. Most women asserted in the focus groups that women or mothers always have the right to the family home, if you divorce. And in fact, the civil code provides for the parent that has custody of the children to have the right to remain in the family home till the children reach 18 years of age. Okay. So in a divorce settlement, it can't be sold, for quite a long period of time, depending on the age of your children. So patrimonial violence comes across, if a husband insists, then the home is sold. And we heard in the focus groups a number of cases where this was happening. And this is where we start to get the link to domestic violence or intimate partner violence, because it was particularly in situations of intimate partner violence where women will do anything to get out of a bad relationship. So if it means moving out of the family home to sell it, to divide the proceeds, you're more than happy to disregard your property rights to be able to leave the relationship. So I think this provides one of the very nice examples of how these are all linked together. Another area of confusion that can lead to patrimonial violence is the very common situation of a woman or a man having inherited a plot of land or an urban lot and then building a home together with her partner. Okay? So technically, that house that you've constructed together, brick by brick, as in the case of the popular sector, is joint community property. But legally, that inheritance belongs to the other spouse. So what often happens, and certainly according to the focus groups, it happened more to women than men, we don't have the quantitative data on this, is that in a divorce, a judge would treat the whole home and the lot as one unit, and so the property would be divided in half. So the person who had inherited that lot basically loses out. And the problem here is the lack of property titles. The fact that inheritances in particular are rarely documented. So when it comes time to do these legal transactions, you don't really have the evidence for it to be taken into account. As I mentioned, these capitulaciones, there's no good English translation. It's a legal arrangement that you can make over any specific kind of property. We found that those or separation of property as a marital regime, were very frequent. In our survey, less than 2% of the sample noted having used a capitulación, which would be one way to protect that inheritance. You don't have the formal paper because maybe it's in the name of a great-grandfather, and it would take forever to try to legalize it. But you can go into this capitulación, that says, hey, I inherited this from my mother, and or she's designated me as the heir, and that would at least be, give you some basis to stand on. What was interesting was that the majority of people using these legal mechanisms were those that were marrying for the second time. In other words, that it's not socially appropriate, to go and be explicit over property. But once you've suffered patrimonial violence, once you've fought over assets as a result of separation, then you're much more likely to go, okay, it might not be socially appropriate, but I'm never going to let that experience happen again, right? So I'm either going to do separation of property, so everything that I have with me now is going to remain my own, you know, or we're going to make sure about what happens later on. And this was particularly, I mean, the women were concerned not only about themselves, but they were also concerned about the children. You know, in Ecuador, just as in the U.S., it's very common for two families to come together because of high rates of divorce. You know, you often have families intermingling, and both men and women are concerned about the inheritance rights of other children, you know, that belong to other spouses, et cetera, et cetera. So one way you keep this straight is by declaring separation of property or using capitulaciones. You know, and that way, at the time of inheritance, you're not going to get all these huge fights, you know, among the children and half-brothers and sisters. Okay, let me see just a few things about consensual unions. Now, these are very common in Ecuador, you know, 28% of our sample. That's pretty high. And it's much more frequent on the coast than in the highlands, where marriages are really the norm. And we found a lot of confusion among these, partly related to the fact that on your ID card, your marital status in Ecuador is listed, but if you're in a consensual union, you appear as single. Right. So if you're married and you go, let's say, to a real estate agent to buy a house, first thing he's going to ask is, okay, are you married? Let me see your ID card, because he has to see your signature. But if you say, hey, I'm single, okay, well, he's not going to ask, are you living with someone, by the way? You know, the question would sound as strange as I just put it to you. So this means that in a consensual union, it's much more likely that assets will be purchased by a person individually, and that only their name will appear on the asset. So, in addition, these are rarely registered. We asked that in the survey, and less than 10% were registered. So there's no proof that you live together with this person for the 2 years. And what a number of people in the focus groups kept referring to is that, you know, hey, you bring some kind of a charge against your partner, and all he has to say is, hey, you know, this relationship wasn't monogamous. You know, I had another woman, and I have children with her. So our relationship doesn't qualify for domestic union. So this motorcycle that I bought, you know, whoever's funds, is mine. You know, and really there's no recourse to it. So this partly explains why women in consensual unions are much less likely, it seemed, in the qualitative data to pursue their property rights. When they do get involved in legal actions, it's for child support. You know, that tends to be the primary concern. Okay, what about widowhood? In the focus groups, we saw that most women understood that, you know, if the marriage, or should they become widowed, that half that community property would belong to them, and the other half to the children, who are the designated or forced heirs under Ecuadorian law. But it was interesting how they tend to confuse that half of the marital property, you know, because the first thing that they would tell us is that they have inherited from their husbands. You know, that they really tend to recognize half of that community property as their property right. You know, that's what they earned during marriage by the legal terms. There also was little recognition of the fact that they had no rights to the individual patrimony of their deceased husbands. Because under the law of succession, spouses only inherit from each other in the case that there's no children. or offspring from the marriage. So, really, it's very unlikely, that widows will, the only thing they can count on is half of the community property, and they don't really have a right of inheritance. Usually the main asset that there is to divide is the family home. Ecuador, as other Latin American countries, has a fairly high rate of home ownership. It's around 62%. And the family home becomes the joint property of the widow and her children. Just as in the case of divorce, if there's minor children, then the widow has the right to remain in the home till the children are 18. There's some confusion in terms of whether the home can, if the widow can remain in the home until her death. And that isn't clearly stipulated in the civil code. And we had some lawyers and judges tell us, oh yes, that's their legal right, and others tell us, no. But we never found it in the civil code. What you do find is kids pressuring the widow to sell the family home and divide the proceeds. What we found to be the situation of most vulnerability for widows is when the home was already in the name of the children, because this meant that the children could basically do what they please. They can mortgage the home, use it as collateral, lose it, and then leaves the widow homeless, for example. And this was particularly the case because of the common practice of dividing up inheritances while the parents are still alive. Very few people make wills in Ecuador. We found among all classes that the primary means of transferring property was through donations or fictitious purchase-sale contracts. And so the parents basically get together and, in the case of a peasant couple, start designating the inheritance shares. This kid will have this parcel, the other one will have that one, etc. Well, that might clear things up in terms of who's going to inherit what. It also means that on the death of a spouse, there are going to be few assets, to actually, and since, of course, women live longer than men in Ecuador, as other Latin American countries, it's going to be the widow that's going to be in a fairly disadvantageous situation, making them dependent on the goodwill of children. Okay, I've already mentioned turning to inheritance by children. Wills are rarely used, and as I mentioned, advanced inheritance is common. And both in the qualitative research and in the survey, we saw that the general pattern is for sons and daughters to inherit from both of their parents and to inherit equally. Answer to the survey question, about 25% of the adults in our sample had already received an inheritance, or one of their siblings had. So this is about 800 people here responding about whether the inheritance received by themselves and their brothers and sisters was of relatively equal value. And you can see the great majority, 70% of the men and a little bit over 60% of the women answered that yes, there was really no gender bias. However, of those reporting gender bias, you can see that son preference prevails over a female preference, and that women were more likely to report that there was a gender bias of one or the other. But overall, and I think compared to most Latin American countries, we have, I think Ecuador shows a high degree of equality in inheritance. Okay, the reason inheritance is so important is that it seems to be the main way that people accumulate individually owned property, particularly for women. Women are less likely to work before marriage, thus to have the incomes to buy property of some sort while they're single. So the main way that they would accumulate this is, you know, if they inherit something from a parent. So inheritance is really, we can, you know, constitute the fallback position for most women. You know, what they know they can count on in the case of separation, divorce, or widowhood. Okay, to conclude, and I think I'm getting near my time limit, let me tie this in with our study of wealth, because the main purpose of the survey was to be able to quantify what was owned by individually by men and women within households, and to get estimates, their valuation, for which we use market prices in this analysis of what they owned. Okay, might come as a big surprise to you all after hearing all these cases of patrimonial violence, right, during separation and divorce, that overall women own 52% of the wealth in Ecuador. And they represent around 53% of the adult population, 52% of the total population. So we really have a situation of gender equity. Our bias was that we thought that we would be getting, that it would be pretty close. But, you know, when the first result was 52%, the first thing you do is go back and look at your programs. You know, did I make an error in any place? Go back to your survey, and did we miss anything? And but, you know, yet the study of marital and inheritance regimes really says that women in Ecuador and Latin America in general, particularly compared to other regions of the world, are in quite a favorable situation. The great problem is that wealth is distributed very unequally. The Gini wealth or the Gini coefficient is a measure of the concentration of income, or in this case, wealth, with a coefficient of 1.0 being perfect inequality. So a coefficient of 0.68 means that there's a high degree of wealth inequality. The income Gini in Ecuador is around 0.51. So it tells us that wealth is much more concentrated than income. And what this means in practice, you can see here through the following quintile analysis. What we've done here is to break up, well, to order households from the very poorest household over here on quintile one. This would be a zero asset household. We had, I think, 4 zero asset households in the survey, to the very wealthiest household, that in our case was a millionaire, in terms of their asset holdings. I should also note that our survey was truncated because we had a very difficult time interviewing folks of the highest social strata. And after 100% reject in the city of Quito, just gave up. So we've got a truncated sample. So here you can see this incredible degree of inequality, right? We've got our wealthiest quintile, number 5 here, where the average per capita wealth, individual wealth, is $28,000. These are in U.S. dollars. They hold 70% of total household wealth in Ecuador. Okay, but look here at quintile 1 and 2. They own together, 40% of the population owns only 3% of total household wealth, okay? So that's what a high Gini wealth concentration ratio means, an incredible inequality here. Okay, so if we consider, in particular, the very asset poor, or quintile 1, there's also some very interesting characteristics. Smaller household size than other quintiles. Highly feminized, 1.3 adult women per adult man. Men and women in consensual unions are overrepresented here. You know, marriage makes a big difference. If you look at quintile 4 and 5, great majority of them remarry, or total distribution, they're concentrated there. In quintile 1, separated women are overrepresented. And when we looked at female household heads, and their distribution across quintiles, you can see that the great majority of non-partnered household heads, great majority of whom are single mothers, are concentrated in quintile 1. Well, this tells us a lot then in terms of the study of property. Let me just go right into conclusions to try to put these into perspective. Overall, then, what we see is that in Ecuador, women have fairly strong property rights, and overall, these are respected. And where it really stands, or these propositions stands out clearly, is in the comparative context. In Ecuador, women own 52% of the wealth. In Ghana, 30%. In India, 19%. Well, the main difference between, of course, very different cultures and different per capita levels of income are the marital and inheritance regimes. In both Ghana and India, in fact, in all of the countries that were part of the British Commonwealth, separation of property is the main marital regime. So of the three countries, Ecuador is the only country with community property. So that's a major differentiating factor, because women in marriage end up with half of the value of the house, right? And 60% of household wealth is your house, the dwelling, which is a result similar to advanced countries, where the main asset of most families is their home. The other differentiating factor is the inheritance regime. Ecuador is the only country where, by statute, sons and daughters are supposed to inherit equally. Very different than in India and Ghana, where you've got such strong male preference and inheritance. So this is our most important conclusion in the comparative study, is that marital and inheritance regimes really make a difference. And in the case of Ecuador, what explains that 52% is these two combined, that you have gender equity. But, and this is what the story about the quintiles and the Gini coefficient is all about, is that class differences really outweigh gender differences in the distribution of wealth. The bottom 40% that are asset poor are in really a very, very difficult situation. They have few assets to meet emergencies and few assets to help them generate the income to climb out of poverty. We find that it's particularly worrisome that female household heads are overrepresented among the poorest 20%. When we got that result, women own 52% of the wealth, we were worried to present this publicly in Ecuador, going, President Correa has already shut down the National Women's Office. This is going to take women's issues and gender issues totally off the policy agenda. But I think that by our data showing that the asset poverty is really particularly severe for female heads of households. And we've had a long debate in feminist economics in terms of whether female-headed households are poor or not. And I think that this shows that in terms of asset poverty, in the case of Ecuador, they definitely are. So that gender equality at the macro level really hides what's important. That for poor women, you do need gender-friendly policies, and that patrimonial violence, which affects all social classes, has the most severe consequences for the poor. As particularly poor women that have separated from consensual unions, you know, that end up without any assets at all. So what do we do about this? Well, one thing is certainly legal literacy. And we're currently involved in Ecuador in writing a legal manual, a popular education manual, where we're trying to convey these results. Yeah, and the importance for both men and women to understand what's individual and what's joint property. Because it struggles over individual property in particular that are the source of a lot of conflict in the moment of separation. Also, you know, to reduce conflict, it would be important to promote registration of consensual unions, promote the use of capitulaciones, you know, that people don't really know about. Also, I should have added here the importance of titling. You know, there's lots of different reasons that economists have pushed titling. I found a totally different reason, which is I think it's really an important way of protecting people's property rights. And finally, we're recommending that patrimonial, it would be useful if patrimonial violence was recognized as a form of violence against women and their human rights. We have enough examples in our qualitative work of how these are all interrelated. But in the case of Ecuador, they only recognize physical, psychological, and sexual violence. But we hope to have demonstrated that for women's empowerment and well-being, it would be useful to take the next step. Thank you very much.
Questions from the audience?
Yeah.
You know, we're just beginning to be able to save this forever to clean all this data and to be at the point of doing analysis. We thus far, since housing is the main source of wealth or in the composition of wealth, we've done a study of the factors that explains men's and women's home ownership. And it turns out that race is negatively related with the value that you have invested in your home individually, but it's not significantly so. And so that's testing being white or mestizo against being indigenous or Afro-Ecuadorian. So, you know, that's only one series of regression. We've got tons of work ahead. You know, we've really just begun this. We haven't yet really done an analysis of getting within that first quintile, first two quintiles. You know, we see a lot of stuff to do in terms of sort of pathways out of poverty by really studying it. But, so I can't tell you whether the indigenous and Afro-Ecuadorians are concentrated there with female heads of household. You know, we know that for Afro-Ecuadorian women, female headship is a lot more common than for indigenous women. You know, that's from the general anthropological social science. Yeah, great question.
Could you just elaborate, Carmen, just for a second, because I think that was a really good question. I know you think so, too. And I think that you said before that it's really hard to get at the questions of racial and ethnic diversity in Ecuador, partly because of the categorization and definitions and, you know, whether they exist or not. And so when you just said that it's negatively correlated, maybe you should just explain to us all what, in other language, what does that mean, negatively?
First, I mean, I should say that our definition of race and ethnicity was just based on simple self-identification. So we ended up with only 6% self-identifying as indigenous. You know, that's very different if you asked the question, what language is spoken at home? then we'd be much more likely to get 20% Quechua. Or what was the native language, first maternal language of your mother? Well, we'd probably get 60%, or much higher figure. So that's very important. But the census question is self-identification, and that's what we have. It's only 2% Afro-Ecuadorian in our sample. That might be a little bit underrepresented, but probably not by huge amounts. But it's, again, what does it mean if you identify as mulatto answering our survey? You always have these incredible effects. Okay, negatively correlated means that that the value that you've got invested in your home as a homeowner, being indigenous, is less than someone who's white or mestizo. But if it's that significant in the statistical sense, that result is not something you would write up and get any credit for, or you'd want to say, right? You're only looking for statistically significant associations of factors that might explain why some people have more wealth or not invested in more housing.
I have a related question, and that was whether when you were looking at the ways that people understood what were their individual assets from inheritance or prior property, what were couples' assets, if you broke that out by the regions where you studied, because I know that in a lot of areas, certainly in the area where I worked in the Andes in Bolivia, women tended to inherit movable property in the form of animals from their mothers, and men tended to inherit property from their fathers, and I found that women who had a lot of property or value of property did have more rights, more ability to navigate their marriages, less problems with domestic violence, and that area, that parallel transmission doesn't seem to come out in the data that you show, but what they get broken out by region.
Yeah, and they really are significant. Yeah, I didn't get to tell my full story, which is going asset by asset, the tremendous differences that you get. But to, again, our surprise, we expected that land ownership would be, we expected that more men would own land parcels than women, right? And for them to have greater investments in land wealth than women. To our surprise, we got more or less gender equity in the distribution of parcels, but a huge difference between the coast and the highlands. On the coast, relatively few women own any land at all. And in the highlands, we ended up with more women being landowners. But then when we estimated land wealth, women's land wealth nationally and also in the highlands was less than men's. So it really reflects very well the anthropological literature, what we've been following on Ecuador, these incredible differences between coast and Sierra. And I explain all of this by, really going back to the pre-colonial indigenous groups, which were different valley to valley, right, before the Incan conquest. That made a lot of difference, whether you had bilateral inheritance, patrilineal, matrilineal in some cases. You had the same Hispanic civil code in the colonial period, superimposed, right, on all of these groups. But how they played out, it was greatly influenced by what was there before. So as you go through the Andes, you see these incredible variations. And so you find lots of pockets, where women are landowners, but you also find these pockets of sudden preference, where women just don't have any land rights. So, when you do a national survey, it all comes out in the wash, right? So we've ended up, gender equality and landholdings in Ecuador, and that's going to make news. It didn't Ecuador, people, because it doesn't help
across the board.
Hi, thank you so much for such a great lecture. I wanted to share that, first of all, I'm from Persian from Pakistan, and I know that proper grades work in a similar way, and the importance of having a son and family in the area. And we own a house, and it belongs to my youngest brother, who is the youngest of half of four sisters. So you can see that, you know, first of all, the patriarchal system and the hierarchy aren't easy to place. But the inheritance rights all go to him. And I share this story because I wonder if, I know in Pakistan, cultural forces that reinforce the family model is a patriarchal model. And if you at all considered a shift in the family model within Ecuador, you know, maybe moving towards an egalitarian model. And if those forces were influenced by, for example, globalization or jobs moving to places like Ecuador, and because women are looking for jobs, whether it's the factory impacting or not, them, they're generating family, and they are also rather almost of this of the family, and because they're aware of their work and labor that goes into the hard work, they're able to understand the parents more, or they're more aware of what they own. And I wonder if that could be a variable that influences why they're more aware, because I saw something in charts of that, like women who are more, you know, they're far more higher than
You've just qualified for feminist economics. You've listed all of the variables that we're concerned about. Yet that's what we need to figure out, right? To promote the gender equality. You know, that's what we want to do. So we need to analyze all of these to see under what situations do they give you the head up, you know? We're stressing marital and inheritance regimes because that's sort of the most obvious as we compare these, you know, three such different countries.